So let me ask you a question. What do you get when you put a journalist with integrity in the same space as a public health professional during a pandemic? You get the realest conversation that you will ever find. Okay, maybe not ever, but you're going to get a really good conversation. And I say that because it'll be grounded, full of information and conversation that will shine a light on issues that require the light of our public attention. We have to understand we are in a space right now that requires us to care more than we've ever cared before. Because information is so abundant, we have to know how we should focus. So today, bringing back his hosting duties is Jay Boyd, a journalistic pro, and he's having a conversation with Thelma Navarro, a public health professional, and they're going to talk about the issues that address our country and our world in public health across borders. And I want you to understand that this conversation is one that I want you to take time to think about what they're saying, address it with real critical thinking, and appreciate the direction that we can go, and appreciate the heart that they're going to give you today. So with that being said, I want you to know that it takes special people to seek public good, and you're about to listen to two special people. So with that, let's go.
How you doing? Good afternoon. This is Jay Boyd. I'm your host for this version of the Friends and Family podcast. This week we have Thelma. She is a public health graduate student at San Diego State University out in California. Thelma, how you doing?
I'm doing great in this very hot day.
California is all about the heat. We're experiencing a lot of the same here in North Carolina.
Oh yeah, it's been a blast lately.
So how's school going for you? How are you enjoying it?
It's great. I'll be starting my second year this Monday. So right now I'm just mentally preparing to go back to the regular academic setting, I guess. Even though it'll be from home, it's still a shift.
I'm sure this time has been interesting for you. A lot of things have been going on in the public health sector with the coronavirus that's still going through our country. How has that been for you even throughout the summer?
Oh, it was a complete shift. I work at the county and everyone pretty much dropped their regular role or transitioned to a new role, dropped their projects, and then just focused on COVID-19. We created different sectors to make sure that everything was handled appropriately according to businesses' needs, education, like pretty much just everything. And it was just very weird to drop what we were all used to or the mission of our offices and learn how to deal with the pandemic.
So how much has your role changed during this pandemic?
Completely. Well, also in the middle of a pandemic on April 10th specifically, I transitioned to a new office within the county. And so my current role got started in the middle of COVID-19.
Okay.
So my experience is different from others that I had to completely, as I mentioned, like drop their projects, drop every other thing that they were working on, and then start focusing on COVID-19. I just got started with my current role in the middle of the pandemic. So my role so far has only been around that.
What types of things have you specifically been working on through your job?
So San Diego divided up into, I forget how many sectors, but my job, my office, the Office of Border Health, is under the binational sector. So my office, specifically me and two other coworkers, have been working on biweekly newsletters to compile data and other type of information and resources that can share with different partners focusing on binational health. They're just interested in learning about binational health. And so the resources that we push forward and share and the statistics that we're sharing are both from north and south of the border. And we cover Imperial County, Mexicali, Tijuana, and San Diego. So that's been part of the role. And then just projects as they come along. I find this to be super interesting things that we've been working on is collaborating with organizations from Tijuana and others from San Diego as well to work on protocols for transporter patients. So patients that, for example, U.S. citizens that are in Tijuana get COVID-19 and need to be transported to San Diego, to get care. Or there's been some patients that live in San Diego, also U.S. citizens, that want to be transferred to Tijuana pretty much just to die from COVID-19 that refuse treatment or who are very ill. So it's been really interesting.
So what originally interested you in public health? Obviously, you got started in that field way before the pandemic hit.
So I come from an immigrant household, and throughout my year growing up, my family's also mid-status. Well, now we're all U.S. citizens, okay. But being mid-status and being at some point initially undocumented and then being a U.S. resident, now being a U.S. citizen, we went through various aspects of the U.S. healthcare system, from being undocumented and uninsured and then having great healthcare coverage through my employer and then experiencing various barriers to access based on the geographic set I relied on. So when we got to the U.S., we were living in the Inland Empire, which has a huge physician shortage, insufficient number of healthcare facilities. So, for example, my mom had breast cancer. She had 3 different diagnoses, and then I have epilepsy. For us to be able to see a specialist, we would have to drive about an hour away from the small town that we live to be able to get care and be able to get our medication and everything. Wow. And then for undergrad, I moved to Los Angeles to go to UCLA. And access to care in Westwood, the West LA area, a more affluent area, was so much easier. I had Kaiser clinics, like 2 or 3 within, LA traffic made it a longer drive, but within like a 10-mile radius.
Yeah.
So I just noticed that, I didn't know what it was. I just knew as a child that this shouldn't be okay. My mom shouldn't have to drive 1 hour to get chemotherapy, or we shouldn't have to struggle so much to get someone that can translate. There should be better representation of people of color that are able to provide more culturally, linguistically appropriate services. And once I got to UCLA, I took a medical sociology course, which introduced me to public health. And it just kind of, it was like an epiphany. I'm like, okay, so this is a field that addresses everything that I was aware of, but I couldn't put a name to it.
Wow. So now that you have all of this experience in the public health realm and you've been doing this work, what do you plan on doing with that stuff after you get your graduate degree from San Diego State?
That's definitely in the works. And so I am in the health management and policy division. As of now, the goal is to manage a health education department within a hospital or within a federally qualified health centers. Or at least that's one of the options. I'm also looking into management of nonprofits or going into health advocacy. So I'm just all over the place and trying to figure out what role it is that I can do that fulfills at least majority of my interest. So that should be interesting within the couple of job hunting.
Well, it sounds like all of those things all kind of tie together. You said that it was just like your community that you were in when you guys originally moved to California that interested you in that to begin with?
Yes. So the city that I raised in when I was growing up, it's majority Black and Latinx people that live there.
Yeah.
And, nationwide, there's a lot of health inequities that affect both Black and Brown people across the country.
Yeah.
And once I got to LA and I saw a more diverse city being in Westwood, it just kind of solidified the fact that, things are not the same for white people in comparison to people of color when it comes to healthcare delivery, healthcare access, healthcare outcomes. So, I kind of connect to all of the different cities that I've lived in. That's my community. I grew up being semi a transporter individual, going back to Mexico to visit my family a lot, relying on the healthcare system in Mexico many times when we couldn't afford healthcare here in the US. So I connect a lot with the immigrant community and then just other minorities in general. And so that's why, as a whole, like helping people from different socioeconomic statuses, from different cultures, different racial, ethnic backgrounds, I just want to make sure that throughout my career, I can try to ameliorate some the many, many, many gaps that exist in the system.
That's really interesting, and it's so true, and all of that stuff kind of ties into the moment that we're in right now, where we're in the middle of a pandemic, but we're also in the middle of like this great social justice movement. How have you seen some of those things change while both of those things have been colliding?
It's been really interesting. As I mentioned earlier, the pandemic didn't exactly create any additional gaps. All it did was heighten them even more and made them so much more obvious. And of course, the interesting part about the pandemic is that it's affecting everyone, whether it's from an economic aspect or even a social aspect, you know, everyone not being able to see their families as much or at all if they're immunocompromised, not being able to go out and whatever it is that they did for their social lives. And then when you really dig in there, you can start to see the social inequities, like the fact that, for example, in San Diego, Latinx people make up about one third of the population, but we make up nearly 70% of the COVID cases.
Wow.
And then in various states, various cities, there's, for example, in Chicago or in Illinois, I think Black people make up about 15-ish% of the population, but they make up about 70% of the deaths in Chicago. Wow. Due to COVID-19. So there's all these things that we were aware that Black people and other minorities are affected by different diseases in a way different aspect, whether it's from genetics, generational trauma, epigenetics, all of that stuff. But now it's like, you cannot deny this. Like, this is, how is it that, you know, Latinx people make up 30-ish%, but we're 70% of the cases? And how it is it that Black people make up 15-ish% of Illinois, but they make up about 70% of the deaths in certain areas? So there's just these things that people kept denying, that race or health is affected by race or it's affected by your socioeconomic status, but it's like, you can't deny that anymore. It's right there, and it continues to be right there, and it continues to be heightened. Even as COVID-19 starts being controlled in certain areas, it starts being controlled for certain people. The healthcare system is created to improve the health of certain populations, but a lot of them end up being left behind.
That's so true. And it seems that, do you think that people in the health industry and then the public health industry have become more informed on those issues?
What is causing the inequalities? Like, for example, they'll say Black people are more prone to diabetes, or Latinx people are more likely to have jobs that put them like on the front lines of COVID-19, but they're not addressing why it is that that structure exists. Why is it that Black people are more prone to these chronic illnesses? Why is it that more Latinx people are more prone to be on the front lines, you know, make up a small number of the population, but the majority of the frontline workers? So there's all these other things, and it's been very frustrating to see people acknowledge the fact that these inequities are there, but refuse to acknowledge the fact that it is racial inequality that are causing these. You know, it's different systems for different races. It's different systems for different geographic settings.
Yeah.
And my office has been absolutely great in pushing forward and not only using the proper language when addressing these inequities, because it's important for us to say this as like, this is racism. This is racism that's affecting you. We don't have to sugarcoat things. The fact that we have sugarcoated things for so many years, it's what has enforced these inequities and what has normalized them. So there's been a lot of push for linguistic shift of different things for us to address things by acknowledging the fact that this exists and we need to stop sugarcoating this. And there's been a lot of different trainings in that. And then when it comes to these social uprisings that have been going on for, you know, that started late May, there's been a lot of trainings or open discussions ran by the Black community within the county and Department of San Diego and across the country in general, that's giving Black people the space for them to, you know what, like your industry, your system, this work environment is racist. and they have been silenced for so many years. But as of late May, it's same as COVID-19. They have made racism and all these social inequities so much more in your face that people that previously denied it or turned a blind eye to it are forced to face it and forced to face our own prejudice and our own racism that we have enforced by being silent or by maybe doing those things ourselves that we were not aware of.
Yeah, I think that was 100% correct. And I really liked the part where you spoke on using the correct language when addressing some of these things, because in my field of journalism and in any field, language is super important. And I feel like that's one of the things that's been like at the head of the moment that we're in right now, where there's like this social justice movement colliding with a pandemic, and people are realizing that language is very important, and that the use of language, and it doesn't matter like how small the sentence is or who you're talking to or what the what the parameters of the conversation are, language is very important, and people need to use their words wisely no matter what time it is. What do you think has changed the most in this moment for you guys in the public health field?
One thing that, well, for sure, given that, you know, so many offices and so many immunocompromised people and the stay-at-home orders, the thing that has advanced the fastest has been telemedicine, which it has been advancing for years now, but the COVID-19, I mean, put it in the fast lane. And there's now access to mental health services online more frequently. They have hired more mental health practitioners to address, like, for example, domestic violence was on the rise when this started. And same as like mental health issues started worsening for a lot of people during COVID-19. And it's just crazy to think about how difficult it has been before for many individuals to schedule appointments. But now that they made it through telemedicine, suddenly there's more appointments available. So there's this kind of like frustration that a lot of public health people hold, because we've been pushing to make so many services more accessible to people that have mobility issues or that have transportation issues. And now we know that this was possible all along, but people just didn't put that much importance to it. So that part is like, I guess, glass half full when it comes to a pandemic, making telemedicine and healthcare services more accessible to a lot of vulnerable populations or underserved populations.
Do you think those things continue post-pandemic? I feel like there's been a lot of changes that we've seen with, I guess, logistics of going places and being out in the community now, that I feel like are probably going to be long-term changes. They won't be just in this pandemic. They'll continue on after. Do you think telemedicine will continue to be a strong trend even after the coronavirus passes as well?
I hope so. And this is something that, you know, a lot of different, not just healthcare, but a lot of different fields are saving money now that they don't have to have, you know, for example, an office. I've seen some of my friends that their employers told them that they're going to be transitioning completely to online, and now they're going to be saving money from rent, for example, or don't have to hire staff for specific issues and all these other things. And I hope that when it comes to healthcare, there's going to be a push even once COVID-19 starts to settle a little bit more, that people are gonna, you know, be more in the faces of different people that hold leadership roles in public health and make sure that this sticks, because this is so necessary for so many populations. And for sure, I'll be one of them trying to push for this to remain.
Because all these things kind of go back to accessibility at the end of the day, right? So it's just all about like, does every community have the same access to these things? And that kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, that a lot of these vulnerable communities and these marginalized communities just don't have the same access to the healthcare that maybe these white populations do in the exact same city. So it all just kind of ties together in that way, does it not?
Yes, definitely. And so I feel like a lot of people use access as a semi-banded approach or banded term, because technically speaking, we all have access, or we all have these services available to us, but it's like, how accessible is it? What barriers exist for us to get there? And then you dive into the utilization of healthcare services, and there's inequalities in there as well. So as you were mentioning, like, this is completely different. There's different systems for different populations.
So I kind of want to tie together at both of our fields. How do you think the media has done of portraying the seriousness of this disease? And then, or how have you seen that portrayed in the media? Have you enjoyed the coverage of it, or what?
So when it comes to marketing, or specific like media that focuses on public health, I've seen a lot of the whole sugarcoating it. So in my office, we keep pulling out all these different articles that are coming out that acknowledge the fact that, well, Black people or Latinx people are more affected by this. And then they'll stop it there. So they're saying they're more affected, but then they ignore the racism behind it. Yeah. And that's just something that has been across the board. And there's been some organizations that are more rightfully blunt about it and say, well, these inequities exist because XYZ. But those organizations get a lot of pushback from public health, from people in leadership of public health, or from community members talking about, well, this is BS, like, this doesn't really exist or whatever. You know, those people that continue wanting to purposely deny, turn a blind eye to all of this. So, I mean, what do you think when it comes to the kind of pushback that people get when, you know, they call out things as it is?
I think it's kind of, it's all based in integrity. I mean, once you sign up for a job in journalism, you know, your job is going to be to discover facts and to report the truth as it is. It doesn't matter whether you enjoy that truth or if you agree with that truth or not. If it's a fact, it's a fact. So I feel like there's a lot of, I was going to ask, which medium do you think does the best job of telling the truth? Because I still believe, even though not as many people read the newspaper on a daily basis, the newspapers have done a fantastic job of kind of pushing back on some of these things and saying, yeah, okay, well, like you said, Illinois had a 15% population of Black people, and though in some communities it was 70% of their coronavirus deaths were from the Black community. I think the newspapers have done a fantastic job of using numbers like that to show that this is a disparity in access to those healthcare mediums. So I think maybe TV could be the best medium for that, because it's visual and it's audio, and it could bring together some really quality stories. And I think there's been some of that around, but it's been kind of hard because it kind of goes back to what you were saying, that there's a lot of backlash when people tell the truth and it's an inconvenient truth for some populations. So if, let's say, a TV station is to go out and say, yes, this is happening, the disparities are wild, and it's tied to just a system of systemic oppression, then their phone would be ringing off the hook for the next week, because people do not like feeling like they've been attacked in any way. And it just comes to, I mean, it's a weak mindset, but just to, people don't like inconvenient truths or truths that they feel like target them.
Definitely. And that links back to how you mentioned integrity, like, how much are you able to take to put the truth out there? And definitely TV, and in a lot of communities, radio is the best way to reach out to community members and get the information out there. But even those that do put the statistics out there, it's difficult for the general population to understand what these statistics mean. Yeah. And that's where I've seen a lot of individuals try to encourage these media outlets to not only state the fact that these inequities are there and give the numbers and make like a statement as to, well, these Black or Latinx communities are more affected, but they need to also say why it is that they're more affected. Absolutely. And give the proper resources. And then for a lot of marketing strategies, their strategy is for pretty much kind of racist. We've had a lot of different marketing strategies continue to provide the same type of information. Like, you, there's so much need that you can get out of telling people how to wear a mask. After that, they need to say why it is that you need to continue following these protocols. They need to be able to properly explain how testing is done, you know, the window period that you should be waiting, the fact that even after you get tested, you need to get retested again if there's possible exposure to COVID-19 again. And then there's just all these other things, and they keep doing kind of like just the most superficial information that they can provide. But, and this is just for all communities in general, they need to address it. They need to change their language appropriately to each community that they're targeting. And not only their language, but the way that they reach out, you know, for those communities that may not have access to the internet, and just that, or those communities that will not be spending hours reading articles. Well, how can you put this out there on TV? Or how can you put this out there in the radio? And how is it that, you know, what's that hook that you can use to grab their attention, and then change that out according to each community that they're reaching out to? And I have seen some marketing strategies that are more appropriate, but I think that's more from smaller organizations or smaller companies that have more freedom in the kind of language that they can use, or that have a more specific audience so that they can focus on that audience better and address their specific audience better. But there's also a lot of companies and a lot of organizations that have a broader audience, a broader community that they're serving, that they're supporting. And then I think those, of course, have a harder time adjusting accordingly. But that's, I mean, that's of course understandable. It's difficult to adjust your strategy for everyone.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. I do feel like what you were saying about, there has been some organizations that have attempted to put those numbers out there, but then they don't give proper context with those numbers. I think that's been one of the most important things that I've seen over the coverage of this pandemic, is there hasn't been a consistency, I don't feel like, with some of these stories. So even if a medium has put out the story saying, you know, that these numbers are the virus is disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities because they don't have the same access to healthcare, I don't feel like there's been a longevity to that story where there's been a consistent reporting of multiple angles of that story. Like, okay, so these are the people that are being affected. Okay, let's go talk to those people. Okay, well, let's talk to some of the healthcare officials in that area and see why they aren't getting the resources that maybe the community right next door is getting. Okay, why aren't they getting those resources? Where's the money coming from? You know, there needs to be longevity to their stories, and there needs to be consistency so that proper context can be brought with these numbers. Because if you just put, and it's easy in the news game to put out numbers, and I do feel like I understand that it's hard to do long form stories and to continue coming back to a story each and every day, but I feel like they would get a lot more understanding from their community. And if it's our job as journalists to provide a story and to provide it with the best context that we can and report truth, no matter how inconvenient it may be for somebody to hear, I do feel like there is a million positives to providing a story from multiple angles and not just hitting it one time and leaving it alone, or throwing out a couple of numbers or like buzzwords and then moving on to the next story the next day, and for there to be some consistency in the reporting and to bring true context to the story, talking to different people who provide resources, people that can provide that access, and then of course the people who aren't getting that access and who are being wronged in a lot of these situations. I could talk about this all day. Is there anything that you'd like to add before we wrap it up?
Yes, I love how you brought that up, because a lot of the best articles that I've read or the best marketing strategies that I've seen are those that go to the community and ask them, how can we support you? And then those articles that go ahead and mention specific stories and are exemplifying the voices of the community rather than trying to speak for them, those are the ones that get out the best information. And those are the ones that, as you mentioned, are providing context to these numbers that they're getting out there, because you're not going to grab people's attention by just throwing out numbers or by making very superficial statements. You know, you need to put a face to this. You need to humanize these numbers and make sure that people know, like, hey, this is affecting your neighbor. This is affecting your family member. This can affect you. And this is an example. And listen, learn about this. Listen to what's going on from your community members. Like, a lot of people in different fields just need to stop thinking that it is our role as public health professionals or whatever it is that we might be into to speak for these communities. But instead, we need to learn or figure out how it is that we can give the space to them, how it is that we can exemplify their voices and their experiences.